Like many of us, I've been thinking a lot about AI lately and its threats and its opportunities in higher education. Or maybe it's better to say that I really, really try to think about the opportunities rather than just the threats. In what may be one of the more gut-wrenching moments I've experienced lately, I recently learned that there are a couple of AI tools that one can employ to make AI writing sound more human. Let me say that again. We can now use artificial intelligence to make artificial intelligence sound more human. I can only sigh. I'm Leslie Lindenauer, director of the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Western Connecticut State University in Danbury, Connecticut. Welcome to Tipple, CELT's podcast on all things teaching and learning. Today, in a change of pace, I'm delighted to turn the podcast over to my colleagues. We're lucky to have in the studio today University President Dr. Manohar Singh, Dr. Wynne Gadkar Wilcox, a professor in the Department of History, Philosophy, and World Perspectives, and moderating today's conversation on AI, Dr. Pauline Asenza, a professor of management in Western's Ansell School of Business. Welcome to you all. Cheers.
Leslie already introduced this concept that we're here to talk about AI. So I would like to begin with a little bit more background, and I want to thank Wynne for this. He helped me do some research, or he led me in the direction of doing some interesting research. And so there's an article by Noam Chomsky, Ian Roberts, and Jeffrey Watmull in the New York Times back in March of 2023 that was labeled The False Promise of ChatGPT. And they shared their fear that the most popular and fashionable strain of AI, which is we now know as machine learning, will degrade our science and debase our ethics by incorporating into our technology a fundamentally flawed conception of language and knowledge. So when Chomsky and those folks say true intelligence is demonstrated in the ability to think and express improbable but insightful things and is capable of moral thinking, they're actually making a case for the primacy of human thought. But now, a year later in 2024, AI has demonstrated its ability to compete with humans in several areas, such as forecasting, ideation, and that perhaps has earned it a place as a co-intelligent technology. So one of the propositions right now is, isn't it possible that AI can be a smart machine capable of working with humans to create a better and more humane future? So here in March 2024, it's increasingly obvious we have no idea what the current crop of large language models are capable of. But we also see from some of the research that's been done that it's going to have a large impact on multiple industries. And so all of us, I think, are driven to try to figure out how do we learn ourselves how best to adapt to this new reality. I want to share with you some thoughts from one of my favorite researchers, Ethan Mollick, who's a professor at the Wharton School of University of Pennsylvania, and he studies entrepreneurship and innovation. And he's wondered and written extensively about AI. It's a new book that just came out called Co-Intelligence, in which he encourages taking advantage of the inherent power and weirdness of AI. He believes we're facing exponential change, and it's critical to pay attention. His quote is, "Managers, educators, and policymakers need to recognize that we are living in an AI-haunted world. And we need to both adjust to it and shape it in ways that increase its benefits and mitigate its harms." And he encourages us to use any of the GPT-4 class models and use them enough to learn what they're capable of. He says we should spend 10 hours with one of these tools just to see what's possible. And then what? So I welcome to the discussion today Dr. Manohar Singh, who's the interim president of WCSU, So, Manohar, according to your LinkedIn profile, you espouse an entrepreneurial mindset. You have multidisciplinary interests in finance, macroeconomics, and management strategy. You've also voiced your preference for making decisions based on data. And perhaps that's why you offered to share your opinion of AI and its possible effect on how we make decisions for the future of WCSU. Likewise, welcome to my friend Dr. Wynne Gadkar-Wilcox, the co-chair and professor of history, philosophy, and world perspectives at WCSU. Wynne, you've championed a need to view history through a lens that allows for both local stories and the colonized worldview. You acknowledge that the history of a region is best understood through its interaction with a broader context or the rest of the world. You've also been a vocal supporter of the humanities and the liberal arts, wondering if a focus solely on career preparation might subsume the more general goal of practicing critical thinking and intellectual exploration. So it's no wonder you developed an honors course, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of the Humanities, where you explore the impact of artificial intelligence on the humanities and how it will shape the future of these fields. This is heavy stuff, folks. I'm Dr. Pauline DeSenza. I'm a professor of entrepreneurship and small business management in the Ansell School of Business at WCSU, and I'm continuously curious. I've been asked to host this podcast, which is part of WCSU's Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching's new offering, Tipple. Think of this as a single-serving beverage, something you choose at a party and use to lubricate discussion, share tips with friends, short yet scintillating, leaving you intrigued and hoping for more. So we're going to have some fun here. We're going to share opinions and ideas about how to understand AI and deal with the impact on our lives. And by the way, how does that affect our students? Now, realize we only have 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and we're going to only touch the surface. This may be just part one of a series. Who knows what we might spawn from this event today? And I'm going to be a bit pushy. I'm going to be prompting you, but redirecting the discussion to move the party along. So, Dr. Singh, start us off. What do you think about Ethan Mollick's statement or the belief that we need to both adjust to AI and shape it to be able to live in this AI-haunted world? Dr. Singh.
Thank you so much for welcoming to the program. I am as thrilled as way back in 1995, 1990s, when we were welcoming internet to our laptops, if you would.
Yes.
And at that time also, there were nervous people, and then there were people who were like, "Oh my God, this is the best thing after printing press we have figured out." And I am exactly in the same mode. I'm less nervous, but more optimistic about this. Why am I thinking of that is probably one of the factors that makes me optimistic is that I'm surrounded by people who are brilliant in what they do as an academician and as practitioners of they create the knowledge, expand it in unknown territories, but still with some useful application to advancing human beings and their lives and their culture, if you would. So I do believe that this is a big breakthrough. And yes, just like fire, if you would, we should not be playing with it dangerously, but at the same time, it is most useful in actually solving unsolvable age-old problems, including the climate, if you would, health, if you would, and drug discoveries. In fact, including the limits of human thinking, it can teach us how to really expand our own potential in our thought processes. So I think I am not only optimistic, I can't wait to see it unfold.
That's a great sentiment. I'm really glad you said that. I'm struck. I'm thinking when I'm seeing, I'm able to see you. So I can see that you've been thinking rather seriously about some of these things. And Dr. Singh says it's important that we explore the limits of human thinking. So when, how do you suggest we adjust?
There's so much to say. So first of all, I think it's important to understand where we are exactly. There have been, throughout the course of the last 75 years, a number of outlandish claims about what AI could do. And every single time such an outlandish claim has come up, AI has inevitably fallen short of those claims in the short run. So in the 1960s, computer science researchers suggested that AI would be able to beat a human at a game of chess within 5 years. Now, we know that that actually occurred, but it took 30 years, not five, because in each case, there are barriers, sometimes resource barriers, physical barriers, barriers in terms of electricity generation, all sorts of things that are stumbling blocks along the way. So one thing I think is we don't want to give in to over salesmanship about AI on the questions of, for example, when singularity will occur, when AI will not only obtain intelligence, depending on how we define that, but things like sentience. I think we're much further off than what we know. And I think in general, the problem is not one, a technological one, but a political one, a cultural one. AI is basically, to borrow a Zen Buddhist metaphor from the things I actually know about AI, is in effect an obverse mirror of the human soul. It's maybe a mirror in a house of mirrors, because as we know right now, a problem that is being generated by AI is that there's so much AI content on the internet right now that AI is having unsupervised learning, in which it is learning how to be human, but the products it's learning from are themselves produced by AI. So this is creating a skewing effect that is leading to more supervised learning. So these pitfalls will happen. Culturally, if we understand AI as a product of humans, that means that we need to understand what humans are doing in producing AI. And I fear that we have fewer and fewer opportunities at universities and elsewhere to truly understand what humans are doing and why they're doing it. We spend a lot of time figuring out how to do things, but less time now, I feel, figuring out why to do things or whether to do them. The other thing that Dr. Singh mentioned, which I think is interesting, is that moment in the mid-1990s when we all experienced the internet for the first time. I was in college at UC Berkeley at that time, and I remember everybody learning, you know, going to free seminars, learning how to do HTML. We were all experimenting down to sort of the level of coding with this thing. And there was a feeling of great democratic promise at the start of the internet. I don't think AI has that same feeling, because in the course of the last 30 years, we've produced conglomerates, arguably monopolies, massive corporations like Microsoft and Apple and others, Amazon, that are increasingly harnessing the expertise of this technology. And so there's a political economic problem that exists with AI that's different qualitatively than the invention of the printing press or even the invention of the internet, in terms of whether or not we have the capacity to distribute the promise of AI resources in an equitable way.
Yeah, I think one of the things I want to circle back on, you mentioned the singularity, and I'm not sure everybody understands what that means. So maybe if you could very briefly describe what that singularity, approaching a singularity, and then all bets are off after we reach that point. What is the singularity?
So we're talking about a point in time in the future in which quote-unquote intelligence, and part of the rub is how we define that term, but in, when through machine learning, we have computers that can replicate the intelligence of humans, at least to such an extent that a human being cannot determine in almost every instance in any field what content is computer-generated as opposed to what content is human-generated. So, which would be defined as equal intelligence between AI and humans. Whether that's actually what it is a matter for debate.
Yeah, so you raise an interesting point. It depends on how we define intelligence. And like President Singh, I'm very encouraged by some of the current discussion that's occurring on many different levels. When you turned me on to the work of Bernard Lee, a computer scientist at UC Berkeley, who back in 2020 talked about, again, this cohabitation. But he also was very clear, and he's a computer scientist, so obviously I think he knows more about this than any of us do at this point. But he was very honest about the fact that humans are very different from machines. And he brought up this concept of situated cognition or spatial cognition, or understanding that the machine is part of an ecosystem. And I think he's suggesting that it's going to be very difficult for a machine to actually develop a sense of self and a situated sense of self so that it can acknowledge all of the environment within which it's operating. There was a new article that just came out, I think last week, from a Harvard professor who did some research about that exact thing and said one of the tests that he ran the AI through in comparison with humans, it was a game scenario, and the humans won because AI could not adapt to the changes in the environment because it didn't have the perceptual capacity to be able to make assumptions about, well, if this changed, then that may change as well. So I'm circling back to what Manar said about there is this wonderfully optimistic view that maybe AI is going to help us if we adequately coexist with this entity.
So I would say 100%. I'll do two things to reassure all of us here. One, human intelligence will always be greater than artificial intelligence for the very fact that the default mode in which nature exists is resilience and growth. Artificial intelligence will always be lagging behind because this programming, the coding, the algorithms have to rely on the data that is already generated. But given that the world is dynamic, the nature is dynamic, the earth is dynamic, the number of people being born, the number of ideas being generated by human beings, they will always be at the leading edge, and artificial intelligence algorithms will be following rather than leading in general, because the curiosity, the intelligence, the natural brilliance, if you would, the survival instinct, the resilience, we will always be ahead of artificial intelligence. Why? Because look at this from a circular thing. We will become more intelligent by using artificial intelligence. So it will feed human intelligence to expand boundaries beyond what we can even conceive right now. Just like fire, just like internet, just like medicine, we have fought major big obstacles. I think about 50 years back, somebody was mentioning that we will run out of the petroleum and gasoline. And then other dire consequences, Malthusian theory and all that we will run out of food. Look at technology. We have mastered that. Artificial intelligence is nothing more than a technology that we can and we will master. The other thing I want to highlight here is that artificial intelligence is actually enabling democratization of a lot of things. First and foremost, in higher education, it is enabling easy access, if you would. It's also enabling affordability, if you would. And I can go on and on this. But this democratization is going to unleash a human potential unheard of. Mm. And that's not just my hope. But if you look at human history, we have always advanced, especially in the face of challenges and threats. And for those who are thinking artificial intelligence might be a big threat compared to internet, they are the ones who will actually lead the change, because there is this survival instinct and they will come up with ways to control it rather than be controlled by it.
I love that you're saying that. I'm going to quote again from Bernard Lee, and I apologize, I'm reading from one of his interviews. He said he's encouraging us to think about our relationship with the machines in a different way. Instead of thinking of them as our tools over which we ultimately have complete control, think of them as evolving beings in our ecosystem. So think about that, wouldn't we be co-evolving in some way? Each of us doing what we're best at? Is that possible?
It's only possible if... So first of all, to make the point again, I don't think that we need to be afraid of artificial intelligence, but I do think we need to be afraid of ourselves.
Yes.
So to elaborate that on that just briefly... the real question here is, to what extent is or could artificial intelligence be a public good? Unless it's a public good, then I think that Dr. Singh is wrong about democratization, ultimately, because in previous times when we had technology that is infrastructure-based, we had at least public-private models to disseminate that technology. We think about, for example, telephones or telegraphs or other public utilities. We do not regulate the internet as a public utility in most, with very few exceptions. And we're not treating AI as a public utility. And so if there is democratization potential that's seen in education, I don't deny that there is, but there's an underlying problem, which is that the instruments of those democratization efforts are not public. And so ultimately, in pursuing them, we're actually pursuing an exacerbation of the central political and social issue that we have, at least in North America at this time, which is an increasing gap between the rich and the poor, which is correlated with a gap between those who have access to technology and those who do not.
Yeah, and I think you're echoing, actually, Dr. Lee said the same thing. He said the scariest part of this is not the machine, it's the human and how we proceed with this. So
I'd like to kind of agree with Wen in that we should be afraid of human beings. But should be if we plan to give up on the goodness of human beings. And I will tell you what I mean by this. It's possible that there will always be, from the time immemorial, negative human beings and then predominantly positive human beings. And that's how we survived. And now we are 8 billion people, if not more, in the world. Two things come to my mind. The fear of inequities disallowing us to democratize access to AI is real, but it is not insurmountable. In fact, just like everything else, people have the power. People will vote in those who understand what it needs to be done with AI to be democratized and hence becoming a public good. You can name millions of things. The electricity is cheaper than what it used to be. Telephones are cheaper than what they used to be. Computing power is cheaper than what it is. Medicine is at least available. It may or may not be cheaper, and inequities may be there, but if you go into emergency room, you will certainly survive compared to 60 years back when emergency rooms were not available to this extent. So what I'm saying is that artificial intelligence is scary because it's new. It's human nature. Because it's unknown, we fear unknown. But if we look at human history, we have harnessed the power while minimizing the side effects of unknown forces. So that makes me a little optimistic that democratization will work in the sense people will speak. And those who are either controlling access to this will make laws and policies and rules and regulations and a fair playing field, or they will be pushed aside and somebody else will come and try to make it more of a public good than monopolized.
Wynn, I know you have some issues with this.
Which is good. That's a healthy debate.
Well, it's interesting because I wouldn't say that. I mean, first of all, I'm not an expert on AI itself. I see it as a teaching field for myself, but I'm also not a political economist. But I suppose I have, from a purely man on the street point of view, I suppose I would be concerned that, in my opinion, at least in the United States, our political system is so beholden to moneyed interests, especially at the federal level, that I don't really see us going in any direction with AI that Ray Dalio or the Gates Foundation or Jeff Bezos doesn't already want us to go. So I guess I have a less optimistic view of the power of democracy to ensure public access than President Singh does.
But look at this. Just one sentence, and then I will stop on this particular idea. I'm wanting to bust my own myth if I'm living in a myth. So you too can jointly bust at it. The power of money is there, but you also see that Obama won elections despite many odds. And his campaign was fueled by micro donations, and that was supported because of technology in which he could penetrate into each household and ask for $1, $2 donations. It is true that more and more of privileged is the right word in my mind right now, or under economically served, people are rising to the political landscape. And I'm hoping that this will continue and there will be technology, artificial intelligence including, which will allow someone who's having three jobs, hence is neither politically available to participate in voting or lead an election campaign. Maybe, and this is my hope, artificial intelligence will allow that person to finish his job and give him capacity to think additionally critically and have some spare time to pursue the passion, the compassion, the community engagement, if you would, to pursue the common goals. That's my hope. But the examples of Obama's winning elections, despite not having a lot of money and a fueled by micro campaigns, I think those examples are North Stars for us to be optimistic.
And I would also argue that there's been such a shift in terms of communication and media and access to information. What you do with that information, of course, is another thing. But that access, I think, is shifting the way that we humans are evolving our own ecosystem. And I think that's what makes it exciting and scary in a way too. So even though, when you might point out that there's danger, which I really believe there truly is danger, there might also be, as Manohar is suggesting, some optimistic individuals out there who's saying, let's see what we can do with this now that I am freed to be more participative in this larger ecosystem that's beginning to develop. So, I did want to bring this up again, Manohar, because of your interest in economics. You know mm-hmm. that Daniel Kahneman just passed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bring him up. When you know Daniel Kahneman, you know, and Tversky, the heuristics, judgment under uncertainty, the use of heuristics, and the idea that actually started with Herbert Simon of bounded rationality, that as human beings, we are not rational.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't have the capacity to do that. But on the other side, we have this tremendous extrasensory, if you will, ability to absorb our surroundings and be eternally creative given that. So those are two things the issue of our bounded rationality, and at the same time, our remarkable capacity for curiosity and creativity, those are two things that right now the machines don't have. And again, based on this research that's just come up, it may be that it's going to be very difficult for them to develop an extensive sense of self. So maybe, I'm back to Ethan Mallock again, maybe, again, there's a coexistence, a co-intelligence, ways in which we can partner in completely new and new directions. Maybe that's a way to accommodate both of your perspectives. Do you think that's possible?
I will let Vin answer that because I have a very strong yes to what you just said, but I want to hear Vin first.
So without going into the weeds here, I mean, one thing we have to remember is that whereas in the 90s and early 2000s, AI models were dominated by people in cognitive science with the input of people in philosophy and psychology. And in the late, you know, starting in 2008, 2009, we're increasingly going back to a machine learning approach using neural nets with very little supervision, whose major sort of programming relies solely on correlation. So what these programs are doing is trying to figure out when Dr. Singh writes a 1 and I write a 1, whether they're both a 1 or whether one of them is a 7. Yeah. Effectively, all of the large language models, all of the progress that we've made is in that sphere. Now, we can say that the ability to do fine correlations on language models mimics a kind of intelligence, but it doesn't mimic consciousness, and it doesn't mimic sentience. So I think co-intelligence is exciting, but it's further away, in my opinion, than what some people have prognosticated. I want to go back to one thing that both of you said. So there's a lot of promise that artificial intelligence can make things easier for some people. I just saw a meme on the internet this morning that was probably created by AI, which is deeply ironic, but there was something going around in which somebody asked, you know, I want AI to do my dishes and clean my kitchen so that I can do art and music. Why is it that companies are making AI that can do art and music so I'm freed up to do my dishes and clean my kitchen? And I think that's a very interesting insight, because when you look at what a robotics was focusing on in the 70s and 80s, you see much more of that model.
That's right.
And you might ask yourself, okay, so why is it that the focus of LLMs is to train AI to do things that human beings can already do? And the answer is because large corporations want AI to take human jobs. And I think the one single most important thing that I could say in this podcast is I think it's very important that those of us who are at universities look at this critically, so that when Governor Lamont, for example, has an initiative in which we're training at fairly low levels programmers to go into manufacturing industries in order to program AI to automate those industries, we need to understand that not only are they ridding human jobs from those industries, but they're also ensuring their own obsolescence, because once they effectively train these models, one thing that AI can do very effectively is code itself. So we don't want to be in a situation, right? One of the things that went by in Dr. Singh's comments was that the woman he was talking about was working three jobs. Well, why is she working three jobs? And part of the reason, increasingly, why someone who is in that position has to work three jobs is because artificial intelligence is taking human jobs. And so we don't want to be in a situation in which we're designing programs for the fewer and fewer jobs that continue to be available for humans in these areas, in which we are complicit in creating a situation in which we're making worse the capacity for human employment. Instead, when we think about AI, we need to also think about how, like I said, we create AI as a public good, how we can make sure that the capacities that AI does genuinely have, I agree, to make human beings' lives easier, is done in such a way as to not create the kind of potential political economic crisis that we might see in 20 or 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I'm a little bit hesitant to make a statement about how AI is taking jobs, because I'm not entirely sure that there's enough data out there to demonstrate exactly what jobs are going to be affected. I mean, we all have opinions about that, and there's been a lot of news stories, but I'm still waiting to see exactly how that's going to work. But I would like to redirect the conversation just a little bit to say, let's think about this in our roles as educators. And so we know that AI has already changed the educational landscape in many ways, but how can we best participate in the changes to come? Whether we're optimistic or cautious and concerned, what can we do to participate in the changes to come? What is our role? Dr. Singh, start with you.
Thank you. Just to go back a little bit in our conversation, that is a fascinating meme, that why is it creating art rather than washing dishes? But remember, 50 years back, there was more manual labor and agricultural labor than now because machines have taken over. Your Roomba can clean your room by vacuuming on its own, right? There will be a day when robotics will be advanced enough. We already know they do surgeries. The washing dishes is not a big deal. I do believe it will come. So that means, I was talking to somebody, 43% of American population used to work on fields and farming. Now only 3% does. Those 40% have not been unemployed. They have found restaurants. They have found creative things. They have found more easy, if you would, on human body and mind jobs. They are not as repetitive. They are not as open to or exposed to natural forces. Look where we are with respect to the eradication of poverty and disease and safety of human health. I do believe that the role of educators ties into this basic optimism about what additional knowledge can do. Eventually, human beings are supreme beings on this planet. To our knowledge, maybe at some other planet, there are some other species. Our supremacy only tells us two things. Can we understand what dangers we create for ourselves? Answer is yes. We have not been using nuclear bombs, despite the fact that we have had so many of them we could have used. We figured out how not to use them. We also have fire and poison and this and that. Accidents happen, things will happen. AI will create some criminal minds to go into and do fraudulent things and misrepresent information. And we all hear about elections being meddled with, some AI-generated misinformation and all that. Certainly. But without going into the outcomes of a particular election, I do believe that even in countries that have not yet seen technological advancement as the United States, chances are, and there are some exceptions, I must understand and acknowledge the exception, chances are the democracies of the world are better off with the technology and information revolution, if you would, than they were in the past. Even in countries like England, where king still rules, but as a stamp had, just because democracy, information-driven rights of human beings, literacy, they have fueled up those equitable distribution of resources. I do believe educational institutions have an opportunity here to head-on capture the potential of artificial intelligence. I would certainly see this as educating to create drug discoveries, if you would, in healthcare industry, robotics for surgeries, taking boring jobs like typing and editing and this and that, and then giving those people who are very creative doing this particular job, for example, that may not be as exciting, to go and create something. And then I'm also looking at it, how do I write a business plan? I may be the super brilliant person, but AI can write a better business plan than I am, and then I can go to my professor and some venture capital. Maybe I will have a business. So all those critical thinking skills, expressions, et cetera, can be seen as tool rather than limiting my creative thinkings. That's what I'm hoping for this. Education institutions, the professors like Professor Wen will be leading this. They will be teaching the students, as you are the first one to have AI and humanities, people will follow you as a role model and say, I want to teach it at this university as well. And that is what I am so hopeful of. That Professor Wen, who is skeptical of some people using it for good, is also leading this revolution of educating our students, saying, look, you can capture the good in this and make it public good and make it a better human condition for you tomorrow.
I really love that. Thank you so much. There's this thought that we need to know more about what AI is capable of, what its current configuration is, and the more we learn, the better informed we're going to be to try to participate in co-creating the changes that may be coming. So in general, again, how do you think we can best participate as educators in helping make this? And I'm on that co-creation, co-intelligence, let's work together to create an ecosystem that benefits all. What do you think our role is, Wen?
Well, on this subject, I think that all three of us are in agreement on the point that universities do need to be examining AI very carefully in this moment and understanding it as best we can. I would emphasize again a point that I don't think either one of you disagree with, which is that we need to do that across all fields at the university, not just in computer science, but also in management and in economics and in history. And we need to be looking at it from all perspectives. I think, just to conclude about this, the thing that inspired this course more than anything is that in March of 2023, I asked ChatGPT, 25 years from now, if you look at the environment, how can a student select a college major that makes them most likely to have a job 25 years from now? And ChatGPT said, well, you need to do the things that AI is not very good at doing, or it takes longer to do. And it listed a whole bunch of things like art and music and poetry and education, because these are the areas where AI is going to lag behind. AI, ironically, is actually, I just read a study that said AI is actually very good at producing business plans. I'm not sure why that is, but I hear it is. But still, if you're going to have a successful business, there's all sorts of human touches that are necessary for all businesses. So yeah, we're all on the same page. We need to, universities need to remake themselves to respond to this, but they need to understand that that doesn't just mean that we're training computer scientists. It's much broader than that.
So I would echo Wen's comment on that. And I would add one sentence to this. Artificial intelligence and the language models are based upon data/information already produced. Let's look at human beings as an original thinker. The seed is planted in your brain, and I think that is innate to human beings. Artificial intelligence is based upon, it can go down, seek information, and then produce results based upon the information it has. But the creativity of human mind I think is something innate to human beings only. We will think fresh. A business plan can be created by artificial intelligence, but a business idea, fresh, that has never, ever been thought, can only be created by a human being. Why? Artificial intelligence cannot do that, and why I'm so confident of human beings? Because we are an evolving species. World is changing. The problems that an entrepreneur is trying to solve tomorrow did not exist yesterday. Hence, artificial intelligence will only lag behind to identify the problem that exists today, but before it identified, somebody is already thinking and trying to solve it. So I think we will be always one step ahead. And then we will train artificial intelligence to take the boring part of the existence back away and then leave us alone to do things that we are fascinated about.
I love it. And I would just like to add, and I'm going to provide some closing remarks because I think it's time for us to end this initial conversation on this very exciting topic. But I want to share with you my approach to business or any kind of success. And it's a seven-step process, but it begins, Dr. Singh, with identifying an opportunity to solve a problem for someone who's willing to pay you for the solution. That identity, the identification of that opportunity is something that is, as you so correctly said, is unique to humans. We have that curiosity. We have that ability to look around and say, why didn't anybody do anything about that over there? They should have figured that out a long time ago. There, we'll be able to use our very creative minds, I think, to come up with problems and then utilize AI to help us define the parameters and the resources and run the numbers and all of that. So I guess I'm going to end by encouraging anyone who may be listening to this to think about what they can do to explore and maybe appropriately adopt some of this exciting technology. I'm back to Ethan Mollick saying, before you make any statements, spend 10 hours playing around with one of these GPT models. Just see what it's capable of. See what things surprise you. See what opportunities emerge as you engage in this play. And then help use the wonderful tool that AI is providing for us to explore new and different areas. So I think that's the message that we're leaving. Wynn, are you okay with that? Let's explore,
yes,
and evaluate and appropriately move forward. And I have a feeling that Dr. Singh is in agreement with me there too.
I am, and I'm going to take one step further, that people like Wynn have already started to identify problems that AI will create and then human beings will try to solve.
Yes. Opportunities on both ends.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you so much. So I want to thank both our guests, Dr. Singh and Gadkar Wilcox, and also the team behind the scenes of Peter Puccio and Scott Volpe of Media Services for their technical expertise. And as a final conclusion, I want to bring it back to Leslie Lindenauer, our wonderful director of CELT, who encourages listeners to continue to listen to exciting and future tipples, where we sort of share a drink and a glass and a chuckle and a gee, what if, single-serving podcasts that offer fun tips for us to consider. So if you want to participate in the party, send your ideas to podcasts@wcsu.edu or let CELT Director Dr. Leslie Lindenauer know at lindenauerl@wcsu.edu. Bye-bye.
As always, if you have ideas about where we should take the podcast and subjects and topics that you'd like us to discuss, please feel free to contact me. I'm Leslie Lindenauer, Director of the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching. Cheers.
Tipple is a production of WCSU Media, engineered by Peter Puccio and produced by Scott Foley. Listen and subscribe on Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at WCSU Podcasts and on the university's Facebook and Twitter pages. And feel free to reach out to us by email at podcasts@wcsu.edu. Thanks for listening.